It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Michael Wardlow as our speaker for the next moment or two. Michael has been around in various roles in this part of the world for some time, as well as serving overseas. He has also served as Director for Integrated Education here in Northern Ireland for a number of years, is a member of the Probation Board, and now serves as Chief Commissioner of the Equality Commission for Northern Ireland. And what Michael has to share gets right to the very heart of the topic that we're trying to address today, namely equality, freedom and religion. Michael, thanks so much for coming. Over to you.
It's always great to get the graveyard session, and that's why I'm using slides. Somebody did say to me, I'm doing slides and talking, can I multitask? Well, the question is, can you multitask as well? And I always find it a bit more useful to use the slides, simply because then you don't have to look at me. And because, you know, my arms need to get longer as I get older. I don't know, is that the trait that you have as well, about reading stuff? So I'm now trying, I'm long-sighted, and I'm hopefully going to be able to read all the stuff on the back. But if I can't, I may have to sort of resort to looking at my little electric device. Anyway, I want to talk about the church in unequal times. And when a number of years ago in our church, in our small group, we looked at Richard Foster's book, Celebration of Discipline. Some of you may have done it. He says this: superficiality is the curse of our age. The doctrine of instant satisfaction is primarily a spiritual problem. The greatest need today is not for a greater number of intelligent or gifted people, but deep people. John Brewer, very recently, who some of you may know, talked about what he calls spiritual capital as juxtaposition to what we're now known as social capital. And he says, spiritual capital describes social impact of religion on believers in society. It's not about how you feel about religion, but it's the consequences of your feelings. That seemed very much to me about what Richard Foster was saying all those years ago. It's getting stuck in. It's going and doing it. There have been varied responses to how Christians respond to the world. And John Stott characterized it in three. He said you can impose the Christian values. We can actually have a laissez-faire, non-interference, or we can use persuasion by argument. And that's tended to be how the parachurch agencies I've been involved with have actually got themselves involved. So you give the example, you give the argument, you work through persuasion. And I think when we're talking then about Northern Ireland, it's been my experience. I started work in what we loosely call community relations in 1973. And this was a truism for me. The boundary between people in Northern Ireland is as much defined by our silence as by our arguments. In other words, whatever you say, say nothing. And in the church, it's been my experience that this has sometimes been worked out in avoidance. I mean, how many churches directly address the issues of peace walls, for example, in a sermon? Or is that maybe too worldly? Sometimes then we have polite indifference. We don't talk about those sorts of things here. But certainly it's been my experience there's been limited dialogue and action. I happened to be in the gents earlier and was in the stall, which makes me sound a bit like a horse, I think. But two gentlemen, I hope, came into the room and didn't know I was there. And one said to the other, isn't it great we've got a day to wrestle with this? And the other one says, yes, we need this day every now and again. And I'm not being flippant, please, but I'm observing the fact that often this is our continued professional development, those of us who are, if you like, come from faith communities. We take time out every now and again to dip into something and then go back in. And having gone through Union College all those years ago for 3 years and trying to think, would that have equipped me for 30 years ministry? I chose not to be ordained, but I went through the college with those who were. And I'm not quite sure how people who are living and breathing with the real life of a broken, fallen world actually can keep up with all the stuff that's being thrown at them. So I welcome this opportunity to throw a few challenges out. John Brewer said this: I fear that the capacity of the institutional church to inherit the future is diminished by its failure to take responsibility for the past. I think that's quite true. Now, a lot of people know that John sort of provokes and John says things just for the sake of an argument, but I think that's also a very good thing. Because when I took this job first, I had people say, how can you be a Christian and work in equality? I had letters saying, you can't possibly stay in that place. Genuinely, I have them. I'm putting them together in a little document. And people are somehow saying this is a two worlds idea. Is equality a biblical value? Let me read. This is Oliver O'Donovan, who some of you may well know. The equality of human beings is an aspect of the doctrine of creation. It locates every human being equally to every other as one summoned out of nothing by the Creator's will, one whose life is contingently a gift, created for fellowship with others and answerable to judgment. In fact, the word saint doesn't appear in the New Testament in the singular. except it's referring to a single person. The saints are always there because fellowship is what we're about. We're made for community. If you then go on to some of the Old Testament texts, God won't ignore the ongoing injustice of social inequality. The rapacious greed, the lust for power, the abuse of the poor, the neglect for the widow, the orphan, the abuse of the alien. And so it goes on. And this one for me struck me because I've been doing some sort of thinking on Corinthians recently. And as you know, this is probably the fourth letter that Paul wrote to this church. And this is something for me where he uses a Greek word that we translate equality. It also means fairness and equity and justice. It says this, "For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what you have. Our desire is not that others might be relieved when you're hard pressed, but there may be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality." Now, I'm not arguing for a minute that that sort of lodges what I'm arguing about today. It's simply saying, when you look in the Old and New Testament, it seems to me that equality in Scripture does not erase difference. So this is not some form of bland uniformity. But it does say, fundamentally, if we as men and women are created in the image of God, then we are rights bearers from birth. We don't earn rights. They're there naturally. And therefore, treating people equally before the law and under the law is important. Interestingly, Scripture rarely uses the word equality. It prefers words that we like in church, such as justice and righteousness. When we're then translating that into the public realm, we talk about formal equality, if you like, before the law. We talk about our substantive equality as people born and created in the image of God. And then we talk about what that looks like in the application. These are aspiration. What does it look like in application? And it seems to me when I look at the Old and New Testament, it's intrinsically about worth and value. It's about the human potential, and it's about our interdependence, our mutual existence as men and women of God before Him. And in that, responsibility is a core component. So, I do not think what we've got in the Bible is some form of bland, leveling equality that makes us all the same, heaven forbid. But we have an equality that, for me, comes as a byproduct of love. And therefore, it seeks an imbalance in favor of the other. And that was interesting that Colin said that this morning. It's about generosity. It is my argument that if we receive as Christians grace, a grace gift is the giving of generosity to others. And I would love to know, for example, when I talk to politicians and I say to them, what's in your manifesto for the other? If I say to someone in a church, what are you doing for the other? And I think, for me anyway, this is a fundamental Christian principle. So what's the challenge to the church? In what's so amazing about grace, this beautiful passage is there. Grace is utter generosity, unselfish, spontaneous, reckless, prodigal generosity, which acts wholly out of loving concern for the other's need, even if he or she is completely unworthy of the love and help that's offered to them. People don't earn it. As Christians, I believe it's incumbent on us as people and followers of Christ to treat others as we want to be treated ourselves. Now, it seems to me that that roots for me something about equality. So, my practical challenge to you as churchmen and women, as Christians, as people trying to live out your faith, is what is your role? How can you help in building a more equal and shared society? Well, our government has decided in its program for government that this new society that we're having here is going to be built on the values of equality and fairness and the ethics of inclusion and good relations. Now, I'm not quite sure what that means. But it does mean that we should be looking within government policies to see if we break them open like a stick of rock, if we examine them in terms of their DNA, are we actually going to find some of those things that we believe have been prefaced in the program for government? I think there's an issue for me. When I talk about equality, people sort of say to me, what do you mean? Okay, what do I mean? Does it mean fairness? Well, not all equality ends up in fairness because there are inequalities that aren't covered by the law. And not all discrimination is unlawful. I, for one, am glad I got my eyes tested free because I'm over 60. Hard as that is maybe for you to accept, I'm over 60. I also have a free bus pass. That is lawful discrimination. So don't confuse discrimination necessarily that it is lawful and that is all unlawful. Is it one for you and one for me? Sometimes in this place, you could fall into that trap. Well, equality means you've got to get and I've got to get. Whereas sometimes equality means two for you and one for me, actually, if we're operating in the spirit of generosity. Is it a progressive agenda? In fact, is it an agenda at all? I would argue it's not. It's utopia. Is it imbalanced? It's all for them. I've been told so often that equality works all one way. And again, it's just to remind myself to say again, this is not an agenda. When Norman and I were talking earlier about equality before I came here, it just struck me that equality means, as Humpty Dumpty said, it means whatever he wants it to mean, neither more nor less. And it seems to me when I asked people this question over the last couple of weeks following the conversation with Norman, some said, oh, that's about equality of treatment. It's how I'm treated. Go into a shop, I should be treated the same. Somebody else said, no, it's equality of access. So let's put all the runners on a plate and it's a circuit as normal and everybody lines up on the same line. That's equality of access. We all have the same starting point until we realize some are running around the outer circuit and it's a longer bit. So in order to redress that, we've got to give someone, put them further along in order that they are actually equal. But it doesn't look equal. He's further than me. And sometimes it's about where you're standing. So is it an equality of opportunity? Which it seems to me that second argument is. Or finally, is it an equality of outcome? Are we saying that everybody has to get the same? Which really is about redistribution of resources, if we're saying that. So everybody going to school has to get 9 good GCSEs, which have to be A's and B's. That is virtually impossible for the 340,000 kids that are going through our system. So it's certainly, for me anyway, it's not about equality of outcome. There is an aspiration that actually says that all people should be treated with dignity and respect. And this is where the interface with human rights comes. Because to set equality apart over there somewhere and say that there's human rights and there's equality is a false premise. The two things are inextricably linked in many ways. And so when people say to me, look at this attack on Christians, what you equality people are doing, it's actually something that about the European Court of Human Rights. And I understand why there's this confusion, because equality and human rights are complementary things. When I worked abroad in helping to deliver some foreign aid, I was working on a human rights framework. I would not have thought of doing it otherwise. It was accepted by Christian churches that they worked on a human rights framework. But somehow when we import it back here, it's not as easy as that, because human rights carries with it certain connotations. So the application then is how we do that. Now, discrimination, generally in this place, I talked earlier about not all discrimination is unlawful. Some discrimination is unlawful. And it's generally around if you're treated differently than somebody else in receiving a good, a facility or a service, or in employment, or in receiving, for example, through public services like a district council or something. If you're treated differently on the grounds of your age, your sexual orientation, your religious or political belief, and so on. Generally speaking, there are anti-discrimination laws that protect you from being so discriminated. The problem is most people actually don't know they exist. Lots of people would not know the limit. I was going to do a quiz at this point, but I felt that probably it would be redundant. It would take much time, but I guess at the end it would have made people feel, actually, I don't know as much as I thought. But our sort of examples when we go out and ask people in Vox Pops and so on tend to show that people generally don't know the protections they have. Also, not all discrimination is direct. Some can be indirect. You can set, for example, criteria for a job that is more likely to be discriminatory for a female because of the hours, for example, that are being worked. Not directly, but indirectly. And we know that. Or maybe we set standards in a job that are unnecessary for the job. They're not an occupational requirement. And we've all been there, this job set up for somebody else. We've all heard people say that. The reason for law and the reason for the commission is that ultimately we live in a world that's broken. I unfortunately have made my living since the 1970s simply because we have a broken world. In another life, I was an insurance surveyor because people had the misfortune to have buildings go up in smoke. I worked overseas following Idi Amin's reign in Uganda, trying to help put a fractured community together. Worked for 4 years in Eastern Europe after the communist period, 15 years in integrated schools, trying to help in some shape or form rebuild some of the fractures of society as one option. And then now with the Equality Commission, I would love to waken up tomorrow and there'd be no need for equality legislation. Absolutely. But legislation is often like a scaffold that's around a building until the building is strong enough to stand without the scaffold. The problem is sometimes people rely on the scaffold too much. It is a fallen world, but listen, discrimination isn't new. Going way back to the ancient Near East, there was a particular Chinese general called Ran Min who said, I don't like people with bushy eyebrows and beards, and he decided he would kill people. And reports are up to 200,000 people were killed simply because they had a physical characteristic he didn't like. In the 13th century, we know there were pogroms against the Jews. They were removed from many places in Europe because allegedly they were the people that put Jesus to death. In the last century, we only have to remember the death camps, the death not just of the Jewish people, but communists, those who were LGBT, those who had mental impairments, all were put to death simply because there was discrimination in practice. Pol Pot's killing fields, Uganda, where I work myself, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and more recently in the Middle East. This is a world where discrimination lies very often at its core. The Life of Pi, Jan Martel, in the middle of the book says this: the main battlefield for good is not in the open ground of the public square, the public arena, but in the small clearing in each human heart. Because that's where prejudice is born. And that's where prejudice, if it's allowed to flourish, can lead into bigotry and discrimination. To have a preference isn't wrong. There's nothing wrong with preference, absolutely. The danger is when your preference becomes something that is bigoted and is used to bang somebody else over the head. Because your assumptions are your windows in the world. And a bit like you need to clean your windows every now and again, it's good to have a good dose of assumption challenging. And sometimes the assumptions, when you take people away, for example, doing cross-community work, a lot of the assumptions people have about the other actually fall away when you realize that those assumptions are not actually borne out in practice. The commission, as it currently is constituted, came about just after the Belfast Agreement. And it took over the Equality and Fair Employment Commission's Disability and Race, and it came together, and the new Equality Commission has now been running since 1999. We also had our colleagues in the Human Rights Commission set up. And you can see there that part of the role that we have in the commission is to oversee the anti-discrimination legislation, and that's some of it. Started off in the 1970s, some of you may remember, my mother-in-law had to resign her job when she got married in the civil service because of the marriage bar in my lifetime. Young women who became pregnant had to leave jobs in my lifetime. And in my lifetime, there were discriminatory practice, and we look at the fair employment legislation about the mixed workforces there are now compared to then. And we move right through until the more recent, in 2006, the age discrimination in terms of not being able to be treated differently because of your age. Just a matter of interest, if I go into a shop and I'm 62 and I'm treated badly because I'm a 62-year-old, am I protected under legislation? Hands up if you think yes. Hands up if you think no. Hands up if you don't know. The answer is there is no age protection at all for goods, facilities and services. So young people can be told, leave your bag at the door and only go to that till in Tesco's or Sainsbury's or wherever, because of their age, without any necessary proof to show that they're more likely to be shoplifters. At the minute, we're trying to get age discrimination moved. And I'm not quite sure that the churches even know that that's going on at the minute. So there's an example for me of something that shouldn't in any shape or form be something that would set apart churches from, the, if you like, those of us who are working within the equality. Interestingly, poverty is not a protected ground. You know, I cannot bring in anti-discrimination legislation to protect people in poverty. Now, whether or not under human rights legislation, if the bill were to come through, we could do something about that. But you look at the direct link between poverty and health and education and living conditions and all the other things that we find, housing, you will see a direct link in terms of performance in schools. Yet it's not something that has protection under equality legislation. There's also an exemption under fair employment and treatment and employment about people with criminal convictions dealing with a violent past, ex-combatants. There are about 50,000 people living with convictions related to the troubles, the past, the conflict. Many of them can't get passports, can't get jobs, can't get house insurance. And now in some cases, siblings and family members are being treated in what may be a discriminatory fashion because of the nature of the legislation. I don't know if you knew that or not. There is now a voluntary code that allows people to employ people despite that exemption, but very few people have picked that up. So again, I'm not sure if the churches, those of you from here, knew about that. Our role has lots of different things, but one is to keep the legislation under review. And so we have an advisory role. We promote, we do research, we do policy development, and of course we do enforcement. The interesting thing is, people will say to me, Michael, is that discriminatory? It is not the role of the commission to decide whether or not something is discriminatory. That is the sole role of an industrial tribunal or a court. In other words, all I can tell you is, it seems to me from what you've told me, you may have suffered a discriminatory act. The staff and the commission can then help that person look at that with their own solicitor or, if necessary, with our support to see if, in fact, they were discriminated against. That's the process. Has equality worked? I would argue it actually has at one level. There's now very high levels of compliance. People monitor their workforces. We now know that workforces are much more balanced than they were when I was growing up in the 1960s. We also know that there's a more balanced workforce in terms of females and women in the workplace. We know that employment practices have improved. We know still that there's some pockets of underrepresentation. But if you take, for example, and I'll give you some stats in a minute to show this, that Catholic underrepresentation has now been dramatically increased. Has been dramatically increased. Would people have done this without legislation? Probably not. So I think what legislation does is it modifies people's behaviours in certain circumstances, but it doesn't always change attitudes. So there is a false premise that says we'll make people change by bringing in a law. I don't think that works in most circumstances. But you wore a seatbelt today because of legislation, not because you wakened up one day and wanted to wear it. People have given up smoking because of the anti-smoking drive. So sometimes legislation can allow you to see a circumstance which is different than what you thought. And that legislation can be a tool, a mechanism to allow you to see, well, actually, that's a good idea. Even if you'd been lukewarm. I mean, pubs were going to close in myriad forms whenever we stopped smoking, if you remember. I remember all the sort of stuff that was happening around that. Seatbelts, infringement of civil liberties, if you remember. I don't know how many of you would even think of getting into the car, even if the legislation disappeared tomorrow. So I'm simply arguing that legislation doesn't change stuff alone. But let's look very, very simply about religion. Way back in the 1972, when I left big school, I did my A-levels in 1972. And in that year, the Catholic population was about 31%. Only 28% of Catholic people who were available for work were economically active. And 46% of those who were unemployed were Catholic. And only 11% of senior government posts were held by Catholics. I mean, looking at that now, with hindsight, that doesn't seem fair. Today, we are monitoring almost 4,000 workplaces. The Catholic share of the workplace is now about 47%, 46.3%. It's up 6 points over the last decade. It's rising by about half a percentage point each year. The private sector is roughly 46%, public sector slightly more. In senior civil service now, we have almost 41% of senior posts held by Catholics. Catholic job applicants now outnumber Protestant job applicants, 51%. And you can see there the growth in the number of Protestants in the workplace was only 6% in the last decade, whereas Catholic growth was 32%. And the other thing, if you look at this against the demography, the under 35 population of Northern Ireland is female and Catholic, the majority population. The majority of children at schools today are Catholic. So in 10, 15 years' time, what may now happen is we may find Protestants beginning to feel they're being discriminated against in the same way as perhaps some Catholics and Nationalists may have done. In terms of females, women are better qualified than males leaving school. More go on to further and higher education. In the police service, way back in 2001, only 13% in PSNI were women. Today, it's about 30%. Senior civil service is now 30% compared to 2. 1 in 6 MLAs in the current sitting of the Assembly, composed, I think it was 1 in 8 previously. And in the current 26 councils, 1 in 4 are led by a female. Belfast has now got the 4 top posts are held by females in Belfast City Council. Would it have happened without legislation? Probably not. There's some other stats there that I'll not go into, but there's a long way to go. Judges, MPs, newspaper editors, and so on. Those are the ones, if you like, that we still haven't got to. So what's the challenge? Discrimination still exists. Absolutely, it's there. And we know that hate-motivated incidents in Northern Ireland are still the majority linked to sectarianism. And 4 people every day report a hate-related incident. That was during 2011-12. When we look at a recent Life and Time survey, young people, 42% of them, said they had encountered racial harassment when they were at school, witnessed it or had the subject. In other words, they were someone maybe from a BME background. The incidents relating to race are about 2 a day. Homophobic incidents are 4 a week. What we know is only about 30% of cases are reported. So multiply that up. And this is a small place of 1.8 million people. So if we know every day we're talking here about two incidents of rates hit are recorded, and that's only 30% of the actual total, something's going on here. Last year, the Commission got over 3,000 complaints to us where people believed they'd been discriminated against. The top one was disability. Almost 40% of people who came to us were discriminated against in their view because they were disabled. One in four was gender. About one in seven was race. And about one in nine was religion and politics. Now, if you then ask, what is the attitude of Northern Ireland? A couple of years ago, we did an attitude survey. And this includes, you know, all of life. This was 1,100 people, so it was a realistic sample. In most cases, the majority of people didn't hold negative views about the other. That's really good. But 30% of people actually said sometimes it's okay to be prejudiced against certain groups. Now, we're not quite sure what that actually means. You can drill it down and look. What for me was more worrying is when you ask people, would you mind a traveller in the family or working with one or living next door? 55% of people said they wouldn't like a traveller as an in-law. One in three said they wouldn't like to work with one. And then when you asked about transgender, not surprisingly, 53%, mostly because people have never met someone who's transgender. LGBT, 42% said they wouldn't like somebody as an in-law who was gay or lesbian. Mental ill health might surprise you. Given the fact that one in four of us will suffer from some mental ill health problem in our lifetime, 37% people said we wouldn't like somebody in the family with mental health problems. Now, there's something going on here, and I'm not quite sure what this is about, but it seems to me that we in the Commission need to be much more in terms of engagement with and working alongside, if you like, broad civil society. And it's great, I find it great to be here today and invited to maybe share some thoughts with you. But we also need to engage more with politicians, with the voluntary and community sector, and with young people. So often when I'm talking to young people, the problems that they talk to me about are not where you fly a flag, frankly. They talk to me about jobs. They talk to me about being safe to walk at night. They talk to me about some of their friends who've been abused because they come from another tradition. Those are the sort of things, and about the world and its problems. Very few of them talk to me about flags and parades. Now, that's not to say in pockets of Northern Ireland that that isn't real. Of course it's real. And I've been with those young people too in North and East Belfast for whom this is their daily reality. So the problem is equality means different things for different people. So I think together we can make a difference. And let me say this to you. Back about 6 years ago, the Equality Commission did a list of key inequalities. And that's what they were. Inequalities in education, Protestant working class boys, mostly in loyalist communities like East Belfast. Employment problems, health problems, housing, public life, where the voice of women in public life, the voice of disabled in public life, the voice of black and ethnic minority communities in public life are not represented, and the growing case of prejudice. We believe there are inequalities there to be addressed. I'm not sure that anybody in this room wouldn't want to stand alongside others who want to try to work to alleviate those inequalities. But you know, in faith terms, sometimes equality is seen as a marginalising thing. It's as if there's a secular value base that comes in that equality attached itself to, and therefore that faith is only reduced to the personal realm. Heaven forbid. I am not a member of a personal religion or faith. I am a Christian who believes that I have Christian responsibilities as salt and light, but that as a community, I am part of the ecclesia, the called out people. Called out of the world for the sake of the world, but not into some sort of heavenly, spiritual, sort of esoteric discussion over there, but to get my hands dirty. Sometimes equality only seems to deal with the difficult issues, and therefore we don't get into the debate, and what we end up doing is antagonism. And it seems to me that the issues that the churches and faith communities have with the equality and human rights agenda, if I can call it that for shorthand at the minute, is issues to do with sexual orientation, issues to do with religious views, for example, Sunday observance or Friday observance, religious practice, and that's like the wearing of a cross or clothing. Sometimes in earlier years, it would have been, believe it or not, in the role of women and what roles women should be allowed into. And then, of course, it's been already touched on today, conscience clauses and reasonable adjustments. It is my view that those are a small amount, although very important amount, for us to discuss. But it's sometimes as though the hand is held up And those are the only things we're looking at. And what we can't see is the broader equality issues that we should be addressing together. And look, there's a list that I can supply to you that actually says, here's how an employer might make reasonable adjustments in the workplace. I do not want things to end up in court, in tribunals. Two-thirds of the cases that come to us, in fact more, it's about three-quarters of the cases that come to our commission, actually don't end up in tribunals or courts. They end up in some form of mediation or mitigation outside. If people sat down, for example, and said, I have a conscience about this, I don't feel I can do that, in a reasonable employment workplace, people can sit down and talk about those things. It's unfortunate that many of these things end up in litigation because I don't think that solves anything. So what's the challenge to the church? T.S. Eliot, hero of mine, said this, to commit oneself to the journey beyond sectarianism is to find oneself with the Magi in T.S. Eliot's poem, no longer at ease with this dispensation. And I think the day that you're at ease with this dispensation is the day that our faith lacks clarity. Because I think that we as Christians should be focusing and shining lights on where we see the dark spots, the brokenness. And I do think that equality for me is a fundamental Judeo-Christian value. I don't think it's something we should walk away of. So my challenge is we need people of courage. We need people willing to be creators and not consumers, leaders and not followers. More importantly, we need people of passion, people who want to see the good of the other. You remember Neymar and that lovely speech? You know, first they came from the communists, but I didn't speak out and so on. Eventually they came for me and no one spoke for me. I've heard it so often, but it still remains true. The question that I raised earlier was the issue to do with generosity. And if I could leave anything with you, apart from the fact I do believe that equality is a fundamental Christian, Judeo-Christian value, I don't think we should simply accept everything that equality says out there, but I don't think that the church's role is to stay outside to create something different. I think that as Christians we need to be involved in debate. That's where I am, where I am. I think we can and do make differences when we come together. A small group of committed people can make a difference. As Marianne Mead said, it's the only thing ever does, and we know that. The problem often is the human rights equality paradigm is so often seen as secular. It's so often seen as anti-Christian, anti-faith. It doesn't have to be there. It is my contention that 90% of trying to support the needs of the other would be supported by all faith communities. Those difficult areas of sexual orientation, difficult areas that I highlighted earlier about how the faith is practiced in the public sphere, I think we need to have long and detailed discussions. I'm involved in that at the minute. Certainly to sit down and throw stones at each other isn't helpful, and whether that's human rights or ourselves. So the challenge for me to you is, the same as I would say to my political friends, what's in your manifesto for the other? If we're people infused with grace, grace needs to be mediated through us through generosity. How do we manifest being generous people? Surely it is looking to the welfare of the others, to the welfare of the city. And how then do we, within this broad realm that I call equality, how do we have to make sure that no one falls behind and we don't actually exhibit any anti-discriminatory behaviour? At the same time, not in any shape or form diminishing faith or relegating faith to the private sphere. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Fascinating tour through the equality agenda.
I'm sitting on the left of Stafford.
Everybody's to the left of me.
You said that.
I'm just interested, Michael, you're obviously a man of Christian commitment and you wear your fish on your lapel.
He's there, yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever feel a tension between your Christian commitments and the work of the Equality Commission? Is there ever a point at which you say, this might be the equality agenda that I'm committed to upholding, but I'm just personally uncomfortable?
I have to say, to date, no. To date, I feel as a Christian, I am involved in a lot of things, the Probation Board, Queen's University, the Equality Commission, and I feel my role there is no different than it was with integrated schools, to bring my Christian values in, to present my arguments through discussion, through dialogue, and through consensus. And I speak on behalf of a commission, and whatever the decision is, whether I agreed or didn't agree with it internally, I speak on behalf of the commission. So therefore, what I can't say is they said this, but I say this, any more than you can do, for example, on a session meeting. But if you're asking me, has there been a point for me that says the Rubicon, that's somewhere where I've crossed. No, there hasn't been. I believe that my colleagues on the commission table, people I talk with, listen to views that all of us have. I'm not the only person from a Christian tradition on the Equality Commission. And a plug, we'll be looking for 11 new members next year. If you feel you would like to get involved in the Equality Commission, fill in the application, because that's one way to actually get involved. So, of course, then what that doesn't mean is that there aren't struggles as a Christian. Of course there are. Because when I'm sitting looking at the assembly and colleagues that are here struggling with a decreasing budget in times of austerity, and I realize in all of that that the most vulnerable are being damaged and are being further marginalized by all of this. And as a Christian, I can't do everything for everybody. And the big thing for me is poverty. That's not a protected group. And what we're trying to do is through other things, you know, through education, through health, through welfare, we're trying to address that issue. But I think the biggest thing, the biggest struggle for me as a Christian is trying to get the churches involved in the debate. That's where I've had more disappointment, if I'm being honest.
Why is that? Particularly Protestant churches, you know, equality hasn't been high on our agenda. It's not something you hear preached many Sundays from the pulpit.
Well, it is, only it's called justice and righteousness. I mean, you know, John Paul Lederach has this great, as you know, story that he uses in Psalm 85 towards the end, where justice and peace, righteousness and mercy meet in the street and embrace, and that's the place he calls reconciliation. So he builds this tower of four pillars and a roof on it, and he says each of those pillars needs to be there to support this place where we can move freely in a place of reconciliation. And I think those things need to be brought to bear. The problem is equality has been seen, let me be honest, it's been seen too often as a green agenda. Because very often equality has meant bringing, let's say, Catholics or nationalists up to where Protestants may or may not perceive themselves to have been. And when people get one thing, it works like a zero sum. So one for you and one for me. Women, exactly the same thing, but I don't have the same problem. You know, very rarely within Protestant church communities would I have the issue about women. But when I'm then talking about maybe, let's say, LGBT, there's automatically, it's a very difficult thing to talk about. Those are the hard conversations we have to have. And this isn't just about same-sex marriage, or it isn't just about a cake. It's actually about how we actually engage as Christians in a broken world, in a fallen world, in an intercultural world, and bring our Christian values in there, respecting the democracy that works through the law-giving. It's been seen as a green agenda, a secular agenda. And to be frank, people needed explained what equality would look like in East Belfast. I've put that challenge to friends in the Orange Order and friends in the churches. I want to come and talk to you. If equality broke out in East Belfast, what would it look like? It would revolutionise the place, in my view. Or North Belfast. I happen to grow up in East Belfast.
Well, you mentioned it, the cake. Is it the case that the Commission would ever have supported legal action against Christians in that kind of situation?
Well, let me explain the background and then the limitations of what I can say. And people will know me and know me that I don't dodge stuff. I'll tell you how it is. The Commission has a budget to support cases. And the support that we give is based on, is there a point of law that has never actually been clarified before? Is there an unrepresented group? And for example, we have very few around special educational needs or, for example, older people. So we look at specific areas and we don't go out looking. That's the first thing. So every year about 3,500 people get in touch with us. That then works through a filter to about 300 cases make it to a committee that we have, a legal funding committee. And the legal funding committee meets every other week. And it then considers these applications. Sometimes they come with a legal view. Sometimes they come before a legal view and we ask for one. And through that 300, they filter down to about 80. And every year we support about 80 cases, of which maybe 10 end up in the courts. Now, in this particular case, what I can say that's in the public record was an individual came, told us the circumstances of what happened to them, and we accepted that particular case to the first stage of support, which means seeking legal advice. Now, we now have senior counsel advice, which we're considering. After that comes either we then issue something or we don't do anything further. Now, I can't go further than that because that's the situation where we have it at the minute. So the next stage is either we say on the basis of legal advice we don't go forward or on the basis of legal advice we do. If it's, for example, we do, then that works through to the, you know, we talk to the lawyers, we try to get settlement and all that stuff. And in any case, if it's we don't, then we don't. And it isn't always after phase one, by the way, we support through. Sometimes in phase one, because if it's a point of law, a council will come back and go, do you know, there's other things in this, and this isn't the best case, or we don't think it's a strong case, or there is no discrimination. And we have public money, so we wouldn't misuse public money. So I think I want to give people a reassurance. Number one, we don't go out looking for cases. The only time we might actually ourselves take action is our duties under public authorities, where we believe that public authorities may have actually strayed in their equality duties. We have the right actually to go and take a paragraph 10 or 11 complaint against them, and we've done that. But in the public realm, we don't. Sorry, in the private realm, we don't do that. So I'm afraid that's as much as I can say at the minute. I'm quite happy once this is all over, you know, we can talk about the consequences of whatever happened. But it's no different than any other case. You know, I have three or four cases ongoing at the minute, which I can't talk about for the same reasons.
Yep. When you look at your website, sure. Michael, there's two or three cases there that you headline. Yep. A bakery worker in Fermanagh.
Yes, the pregnant girl.
Seaman from Belfast.
Yep.
And I think the Equality Commission cost the taxpayer about £10 million a year.
£6.2 million,
okay.
No, there was something, I think Sammy Wilson put £10 million in public domain, but it's 6.2 down to 5.9 this year.
Would those people that you know you have acted on behalf of, would they not be protected normally under the law without your intervention?
Well, the only reason we do is normally what happens, the whole point of staged intervention, let's take Alan Lennon. I mean, people would say we don't support Christians. Alan Lennon was a very high-profile case in terms of the application for the chair of the Water Service. And Alan, we ended up supporting because normally we give support, you know, on the grounds it's a case that has merit. And this particular case, for example, was a public appointment. And there was a suggestion that maybe the normal rules didn't apply to public appointments with ministers and so on. In this particular case, it went through and the judgment was that Alan had been discriminated against on the grounds of a religious opinion. In other words, it was religion. And in that case, I think there was just over about a quarter of a million settlement. Alan would say that that was good, not for the money, because what it's done is say to the ministers and to those making public appointments, you're not outside the law. In terms of the young woman who was pregnant and had the case, she was fired because she was pregnant. And what people don't know is pregnancy, you don't have to have a one-year qualifying period. You can be working 2 weeks and be fired for being pregnant and still be supported under the law. Trade union membership and pregnancy are two of the cases that don't require a one-year period in. So the signal was sent out, you can't do this. The other thing it said was, it doesn't cost you to have a pregnant woman in post because 85 to 90% you get back from the state. So there's this sort of false premise out there. You're telling us we have to employ young women because they're going to get pregnant and it's going to cost us. That's the sort of stuff, Stafford, that we want to get out there. I suppose your short question is, are we value for money? Well, you've got to look at what OFM, DFM say about us. You've got to look at what the money that we're getting and the value that we do and the evaluations that are taking place. And that all says yes. The surveys that we've done of stakeholders have all come back extremely favourable. And there's no distinction orange and green. Right across the divide, I think it's about 80% say we're experts at what we do and they'll come and look for us for support. So my sense, and I'm only 2 years in post and I'm a public appointment, my sense is that it's fit for purpose. There's much more it could do because I think there's a huge amount of people who don't know they have protections, including Christians. You know, there's one case that we haven't publicised. You went and talked about the website. And this raises the issue of the conscience clause because people tell me that, you know, Christians, we need a conscience clause. And I think it was highlighted earlier how difficult that might be. But what I also hear Christians saying is equality always has an equivalent. So in order to know were you discriminated, you need to have a comparator. Were you treated less favourably than me, let's say, as a female? In terms of faith, it's exactly the same. Is a person of faith treated differently than a person outside faith? In disability, that's not the case. Someone who's disabled needs reasonable adjustment. What I often hear from faith communities is, no, that's how we want to be treated. Not are we less favourably treated than somebody else of no faith, but can we have a reasonable adjustment made? So that's another argument that's out there. The problem in this is how do you define conscience?
So the situation, for instance, with the registrar who really felt uncomfortable about officiating at a civil union.
You see, that should never have gone. In my view, this is me speaking, right? I think that reasonable accommodation in 90% of the cases can actually resolve this. Now, it's not as if he or she, I think it was Ladelli, he or she's in the Isle of Skye were the only person who can perform a civil ceremony. This was someone who was a member of a much bigger group. Now, a reasonable adjustment, in my view, would have been someone else could have done that. Now, this, in some way, shape or form, became this sort of sibilathon, was, you know, was held up as something. And it ended up in court, and the court then makes a decision based on the law, and a set of judges or a tribunal, depending on where it is, make a call. The problem is, we have a case where a Muslim woman was told that she couldn't leave work early on a Friday to fulfil her religious obligations, and yet a Christian was told she could on a Sunday. And two different tribunals upheld different... And you're going, where is the logic? And the answer is there isn't. Because these are different sets of jurisprudence that take place and different sets of competing circumstances. And as we heard earlier, these are all about competition and about balancing principles, like the parades here. Yeah. So, Stafford, it's not easy. But I think my own view on that one is there is a legal decision in that, that should not be able to be used. I think there should have been reasonable accommodation before.
You said to me, Michael, that the law can help us
in
that it exposes areas of inconsistency or blind spots in our own thinking.
Yeah.
But you and I as Christian people would know that ultimately the issue of prejudice is one that's born deep in our own hearts. If I as a preacher were wanting to address issues of prejudice in my own heart or in the hearts of my listeners, where would I start biblically?
I think it's about a process. I mean, my experience going back to the 70s working with Christian groups was around community relations. And it's like, for me, the journey to peace is a journey and it's not a destination. So it's sometimes necessary to undo stuff. And I seem to spend a lot of my life taking stones out of ground before I can sow seed. I mean, you know that in the Christian parallel. And a lot of the stuff is undoing the stereotypes. A lot of the stuff is saying, well, you might think that about people from ethnic backgrounds or from women or from... And a lot of that, therefore, is actually challenging the fact that stop and think that when you think that of someone, what is it that makes you think that? Why or do you think that this person is more likely to do this than someone of your own colour or religion or gender? And it is about also, I think it's about accountability as well. I think as Christians, we've moved away from being accountable to other people. You know, in the Christian Protestant tradition, it's very much an individual ethic. And I think there's something to be said for being held to account by other people. And, you know, I have some friends and I said, if you ever hear me saying X, will you challenge me? And they have said the same to me. This is brilliant because shines the light. My partner's brilliant. Karen, 37 years, tells me if I've done something wrong. And I need to be told that because sometimes the word slips out. The other thing, of course, is the language. There is, of course, political correctness that's come in. I grew up in a time whenever coloured was okay to use as someone who was black. My mum may still use that sort of language. And sometimes people don't engage because they're afraid of what word do I use. For example, members of the LGBT community, I'm constantly saying, when people from a Christian tradition say certain things, please don't lead with the word you're homophobic, right? Because that is not going to advance a conversation. And I think this works on both sides. So sometimes it's about language, but I think the biggest thing is an outbreak of grace. I would love to have an outbreak of grace and that's manifest in generosity. That what I'm doing, and I thought what Colin said was brilliant, why is it when my voice is heard in the public sphere, it's talking about me? That's a big challenge. It's me, myself, and I. And I mean, we as Christians live for the other. I'm born for the other. And yet somehow when it comes to equality, there's something falling behind. And I'm simply saying, do not avoid the hard conversations. And the big ones at the minute are those issues that we've just talked about, LGBT, and probably issues about how you practice your Christian faith in the workplace. And I'm up for those conversations.
Michael, thanks very much. We could talk for a long time.